It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says we need to stop playing catch-up with these diseases like Zika and Ebola and start investing in a more effective public health system.
First, Wisconsin Republicans gathered in Green Bay this weekend for the state GOP convention. One potentially contentious item, Republican support for their candidate for president, their likely candidate, Donald Trump. Some officials at the convention this weekend embraced the businessman. Others, like Governor Walker, didn't mention him in their speeches.
J.R. Ross from WisPolitics covered the convention this weekend, and he joins us now to talk about it. He's the editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. How you guys doing today?
Good, thanks. So the big question, at least one of them, a big looming question, is how would the Wisconsin GOP respond to their presumptive nominee, Donald Trump?
Well, it was interesting to talk to people this weekend. There seems this kind of like moment, I don't know if it's really of mourning or kind of coming to grips with it or what it is, but there's almost like this kind of trying to accept the idea of Donald Trump as the expected nominee. Remember that Wisconsin was kind of the focal point of the anti-Trump movement ahead of our primary April 5th, where you saw groups like the Club for Growth come in and spend, you know, big money on ads knocking Donald Trump. You saw talk radio in Milwaukee, conservative talk radio, get behind Ted Cruz and pound on Donald Trump. You saw really an effort here to turn the tide of that primary against Donald Trump. And so these guys who are the core, the hardcore activists of the party, they're personally invested in defeating Donald Trump just a month ago, a month and a half ago, and here they are now with him almost the nominee. It was kind of an odd feeling at times at the convention that they were, like I said, coming to grips with the idea of, okay, now it's time to go out there and support Trump, and can I do this? It was a common theme in talking to people. They weren't quite there yet to be excited about Donald Trump.
And what did the leadership say? The featured speakers, which included Governor Walker, Senator Ron Johnson, Sean Duffy, what did people have to say about that big question?
Well, there was an interesting kind of clear line between the state-elected official speeches and the ones from the congressional delegation. The morning was all the state folks, Governor Walker, Brad Schimmel, Scott Fitzgerald, Robin Voss, Rebecca Clayfish. They all talked about basically being committed to Ron Johnson, you know, Republicans want to get him reelected this fall, the Senate seat. They may sometimes passing mention of getting the quote-unquote right candidate for president elected, but there was no big warm embrace of Donald Trump or no big call to go out there and work for Trump. It was more of a be engaged for Ron Johnson, or like Robin Voss kind of said, you know, the assembly speaker, don't forget about us. You know, kind of go out there, remember that we're out there on the ballot too, come work for us, work for our reforms. In the afternoon, you saw Sean Duffy, Jim Sensenbrenner, Glenn Grotham go out there and really kind of put in a good word for Donald Trump with the delegates, if you will, and say he's the nominee, let's get behind him. I think Sensenbrenner said, you know, he won fair and square, he's the nominee, let's go. And, you know, Duffy, who's from a district that Trump won, one of two in the state, kind of made more of an explicit play, like, let's, you know, he won my district, let's go out there and work for him. But it wasn't really the enthusiastic, you know, backing you'd expect in a presidential year from the state convention.
Well, let's talk Governor Scott Walker expressly. I understand he talked for about 30 minutes and was a candidate himself, so has an interesting history. He's met Donald Trump. He's interacted with him, presumably. How did he handle this?
Governor Walker did not mention Donald Trump by name a single time. He talked about Ron Johnson a lot. He pumped up Senator Johnson, but he really focused on what he calls the continuing Wisconsin comeback, getting the grassroots engaged for Ron Johnson, kind of focusing on his own record. The only Mostly when he brought the presidential race, he made a crack about how he's been on the ballot every even-numbered year for, seems like forever, between the assembly, being county executive, running for governor, the recall election in 12, and how he tried to be in the ballot this fall, you know, mentioned the governor of the president's race, but it didn't work out. So other than that, he really didn't mention the presidential race and did not talk about Donald Trump. And for Walker, it's been this odd dance where he signed a pledge while running for president to support the eventual nominee. He's kind of being a good Republican soldier and saying, I will back the nominee. But you can tell that Donald Trump is not Scott Walker's idea of the ideal presidential candidate for Republicans. So he's not his first choice, even second choice, or third choice. But he's the nominee, and he's kind of getting behind the we need to kind of stop Hillary, if you will. And it's become kind of a common theme of, well, Hillary Clinton would be worse, you know, for our ideals than Donald Trump. So that might be one way to get people motivated to go out and vote this fall.
And so for those folks who did say, yes, it's time to unite behind Donald Trump and stir things up, get that same fervor going for Trump that maybe was seen during the recalls in Wisconsin, What was the reception like? Is this what the people there wanted to hear?
Well, it was interesting. We did a straw poll this weekend where we asked the delegates, alternates, or registered guests, you know, one, who do you want to see as Donald Trump's running mate? Newt Gingrich and John Kasich were the two most popular answers. And two, it was, if things right now end up being Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, would you vote for Trump, vote for Clinton, vote for a third party, or sit out the race? And what was interesting was I think about 80% of the people who responded in our poll or voted, they backed Trump, which you would expect to have a high number in a Republican primary. But a lot of folks who came to the table to vote, you could kind of talk to them, and they would take a deep sigh at their choices and mark down Trump. It's also interesting that, you know, a portion of the people voted said third party. Remember, these are like the hardcore party activists. Not only the activists, these are the ones who man the phone banks during the fall and go out and make calls to get people to turn out. They're the ones who do the donations. They put yard signs up. I mean, these are your core constituency, and they're having a hard time with this. So it kind of tells you that people may be accepting of it at this point or kind of coming to grips with it, but they're not enthusiastic about Donald Trump as a nominee, at least not this swath of Republicans that we saw in Green Bay over the weekend.
We're talking right now to J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com, and he's joining us to talk about the state GOP convention, which wrapped this weekend in Green Bay. And so Ron Johnson, as you said, Senator Ron Johnson, running against Russ Feingold, and in many respects, he was this weekend billed as the marquee race over the presidential race. What did he say when he spoke?
You know, he really tried to put his election in stark terms. I mean, he kind of laid it out that the future of the country is on the line and that his election could go a long way in determining who controls the U.S. Senate this fall, that it really could be about, in his kind of his, kind of, to paraphrase him, about saving America. That's the way he's looking at it. And it really was a very kind of stern warning to the delegates that we need to get involved and engage. We give me back the Senate and preserve our future, if you will. He also made a reference to Flight 93, which was part of the September 11 attacks. That was a flight that was downed by the passengers in the field in Pennsylvania. That raised some eyebrows and got a stern response from Russ Feingold. Johnson's out today saying that it's, I think, quote-unquote, disgusting to try and say he was likening his election to 9/11, but that became one of the storylines. But anyway, he was very much delivering this very stern message of how important this race is and how important it's for them to be engaged this fall.
And looking back at what Governor Walker had to say, you told us what he did not say about Donald Trump. That is, he did not mention him. But what did Governor Walker say about Wisconsin and the political issues that are at play here?
It was really interesting. One, he dipped his toe a little bit in the UW system tenure debate. He's using a line more often now. You're hearing about tenure as that faculty want a job for life. You can tell with Governor Walker that line is playing well in some polling that he has or when he's talked to his advisors, because he's using it more and more, that the faculty who are complaining right now in these no-confidence votes, they want a job for life. They aren't, it's not about freedom, academic freedom for them, but about a job for life. He's been stressing that quite a bit. And he's really been trying his best lately to talk up how well Wisconsin is doing in his mind economically, between the unemployment rate being down, the percentage of people who are working being up, all these good things going on, and kind of putting a positive message on how Wisconsin is doing.
And so if there was an overall theme coming out of this convention at a time where things in politics are just, the dust is just starting to settle now with Donald Trump emerging as the likely nominee, what was the tone like here in Wisconsin?
Oh, I mean, definitely the theme this weekend was about Ron, it was get Ron Johnson reelected. Now, the question that, though, is if you've got an electorate, a base of Republicans who aren't really enthused about Donald Trump, how does that happen? Because you're talking to some of these folks, you're like, well, you know, I don't want to do about the presidential race, but I'm definitely going to turn out for Ron Johnson. Well, how do you get people who the presidential race is the end-all, be-all every 4 years? How do you deliver a message to Republican voters of, well, we're not really excited about this choice over here, but you got to turn out for Ron Johnson? It's a fine line to walk. Normally, the top of the ticket drives turnout down ballot. And this time, you're trying to get people out despite the top of the ticket in some cases. And that's going to be interesting to see if they can pull that off.
Something to watch for the fall for sure. JR, thanks a lot for joining us and catching us up.
Anytime. Have a good day.
You too. That was J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com, and he joined us there to talk about the state GOP convention this weekend in Green Bay.
Coming up, our guest says outbreaks of Zika and Ebola should teach us a lesson. We need more funding of public health systems. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest makes the case that the word misuse is literally the worst. And we hear about your grammatical pet peeves.
First, the spread of the Zika virus from Brazil northward has the U.S. scrambling to prepare for the disease, to prevent it, to treat it, and to look for a vaccine. The CDC is watching for mosquitoes that can carry the disease, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture is recruiting Americans for a citizen science project to help track the whereabouts of those mosquitoes. Meanwhile, Congress is looking at moving anti-Ebola funding to Zika programs.
Our next guest says that we've been here before trying to play catch-up with the latest health threat, from tuberculosis and bioterror to Ebola and Zika, and she says we need to learn a more basic lesson and invest in more public health infrastructure so that we're ready for the next outbreak.
Dr. Celine Gounder joins us now. She's an HIV and infectious diseases specialist and internist in New York City, and she's a physician journalist. Her piece on public health is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Gounder, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob.
So describe our current system. You say we're playing catch-up, putting out one fire after another. How are we reacting to disease outbreaks like the latest, Zika?
Well, the problem in public health in this country is that it's funded through a very convoluted structure. So you have some funding that comes from the federal government, some from the state, and some from local municipalities. And none of that funding is guaranteed year to year. And it's also highly variable in part because of the types of sources that we get that funding from. So at the federal level, it's largely income tax, some corporate taxes. At the state, you're dealing with sales and excise taxes. And at the local level, it's especially variable because you're relying on property taxes. So if you live in a wealthier neighborhood, you have a bigger tax base and more money to address issues like mosquito control for Zika.
So what are the consequences of that when it comes to the practical reality of trying to get a handle on a disease like this?
Well, when you're dealing with a disease like Zika, so something that can spread over city, state boundaries, not to mention international boundaries, you know, you really can't be approaching this kind of infectious disease as this is what's in my backyard and that's your backyard and that's your problem. You know, we really have to have a more holistic, frankly, at least national, if not international, approach. You may remember, you know, going back to the Ebola epidemic in 2014, and so we were talking about having different approaches depending on what airport you might be coming through. And so obviously, when you have such different approaches, different levels of resources available to fight, you're really going to be exposing yourself, at least in certain areas. And with an infectious disease, that's not acceptable because it can continue to spread into unaffected areas.
Now, in the movies and TV and pop culture, there's often the scene where you've got the disease and there's the CDC with vans and trucks and people in hazmat suits rushing in to save the day. That's not really enough. That's not really what we have in place, is it?
No, that's actually a tremendous misconception that the CDC is in charge. You know, honestly, the FBI has far more jurisdiction on something that might be happening locally than does the CDC. And even the FBI has to collaborate with local law enforcement. With the CDC, they're really not the ones that come in and provide the services. They provide technical expertise, advice. A lot of the money that goes to local municipalities for public health is funneled through the CDC, but they're very limited in how much they can actually do on the ground. You know, again, going back to Ebola, remember the transmission that occurred at Dallas Presbyterian Hospital? You know, a lot of people blame the CDC, and that was really more a reflection of what was happening at the hospital level and the local health department. And, you know, CDC eventually came in and said, well, here's our advice, but they have to be invited in and asked to collaborate locally.
So it sounds like the end result here is that we're playing catch up. We're improvising our response with all these different levels of public health control.
Yeah, and, you know, essentially you try to put out one fire, and then all of a sudden that fire is almost put out, like Ebola, and then you just take the money out of that and you apply it to the next thing. And the problem is that when you approach things that way, you're never really addressing any of these issues. You know, a couple of years ago, people were saying, well, why don't we have a vaccine for Ebola? Well, I can tell you, you know, if we reallocate money in this way, you're not going to have a vaccine for Ebola. You know, you're not going to finish the trials that need to be done. That's the kind of money we're talking about reallocating instead to Zika now. So you really do need to have a longer-term approach where you get the job done, you continue to do surveillance, you build up health systems that will prevent diseases from emerging and spreading. So, again, you know, this goes back to the Ebola situation in West Africa. The money part of the money that they're trying to reallocate is money that would build health systems that would detect the next outbreak, and not just Ebola, but some other emerging disease.
Talking to Dr. Celine Gounder, she says we need to change the way we approach public health to, instead of reacting to the latest disease outbreak that's in the headlines, have a longer-term approach. And Dr. Gounder, let's get into what that might look like. What would a better functioning public health system look like when it comes to thinking in the long run, being ahead of the next outbreak?
Well, I think you need to have more reliable funding so that state and local health departments can really plan not just for next year, but longer term than that. And, you know, that's definitely a challenge at the moment. You know, and the other problem is our source of funding, you know, that I was mentioning earlier, is dependent on certain kinds of taxes that make the funding levels year to year highly variable. So some people have talked about, for example, national excise taxes. So an excise tax is essentially folded into the price of a product. So when you fill up your car at the pump, you're actually paying an excise tax on that gasoline, and that tax helps to fund the highway trust fund. So usually an excise tax is applied to something related to what it's going to fund, so gasoline and highways. You know, maybe in this case it would be medical services or health insurance or unhealthy food that you might have an excise tax that could help fund public health activities. Some people have also suggested allocating some proportion of the Medicare trust fund. And there's some logic to that, because if you think about it, public health, it's you know, really great bang for your buck. You prevent disease. And so Medicare, which is funded by the federal government, would definitely, you know, there's an interest for them because you see decreased costs in terms of health utilization in other ways. So, you know, that also makes sense. And then another proposal has been to just make the estate tax permanently extending that, and then using those funds to support public health. So it really comes down to having a long-term, reliable source of funding for this.
When it comes to the kind of medical research that it takes, I imagine, tell me if I'm right, it would be easier to answer that question, why don't we have a vaccine for blank, if we've been constantly picking away at that vaccine, as opposed to, oh, this disease is here, and trying to go from 0 to 60 to come up with that vaccine while we're already contending with that disease. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it takes, you know, in general, 10 plus years to develop a vaccine. From the time that you decide this is something we need to do, you need to first make sure something's safe, that it's effective in a small group of healthy volunteers, and then you take that to a larger group, and then you do population-level studies to see does it actually make a difference in transmission. And that process takes a long time, in part because you want to do these things safely. And so, you know, if we, for example, Zika, we don't have the vaccine, and we won't for this year, next year, or probably for a while after that. And again, it's because we're starting from the beginning. And so it doesn't make sense to put a ton of money into trying to develop a vaccine for a year or two, and then it fades from public view, and then you wasted all of that money, frankly, and don't have a product. So we really need to be doing is thinking about what is the real threat long term, and how do we approach that? And some of that might be vaccine development. Some of it's also just the nuts and bolts of how do you prevent disease transmission in general? How do you monitor for that? And those systems are themselves not strong enough.
And talk about that patchwork. How do we solve that? That, you know, we've got the CDC with limited authority in any local area, state health departments, city and county health departments. How do we get those better coordinated?
You know, I think CDC has learned some lessons from the Ebola epidemic that they're now applying for Zika. So they had basically convened local and state health officials in Atlanta for a meeting about a month ago now to really helps them step-by-step go through their plans for how to respond to Zika virus. You know, it wasn't just lectures in a big hall where people don't talk to each other. It was really more like roundtable, like, okay, I'm from New York City, or I'm from, you know, this township in Wisconsin, and this is how I'm going to be approaching, and having experts there available to help them walk through and chart out their process. So I think they've been much more proactive this time around than they were with Ebola, which I think they were more reacting as opposed to being proactive in their advice. So, I think there are lessons that have been learned, but coordination among the different levels, that's just it's the nature of our system of government in this country, and that will continue to be something of a challenge.
And Dr. Gounder, as we wrap up briefly, it seems like part of the problem here is we have a short attention span as media consumers and as political leaders. What would it take to change that mindset and think disease outbreaks in the long run?
Gosh, I wish I knew. I wish I had a good answer to that one. It's fascinating to me how, whether it's HIV or tuberculosis or Ebola or Zika, how quickly these things fade from public consciousness. And yet you really do have people still suffering from these diseases today. And how to get that message out, I don't know. I don't know if it's a question of really trying, instead of giving stats and sterile numbers, to keep telling stories of the people who are affected so that it really rings true on an emotional level for people.
Dr. Gounder, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That was Dr. Celine Gounder. Her piece on public health and Zika is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we talk about grammar mistakes that get on your nerves. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And that's why I think it's a good
time to learn some grammar. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. So a lot of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners are like Weird Al Yankovic and really concerned about language. Have you ever found yourself saying something like, it's so cold I'm literally freezing my fingers off, or I need to eat or I'm literally going to pass out?
Well, if so, you might be guilty of word misuse, which might get on the nerves of certain language lovers out there.
But we always hear that language is always changing and evolving. So when is a little word misuse not a crime?
We're going to talk about a number of common grammatical mistakes now, and we want to hear from you. What words or phrases just get on your nerves when they're used incorrectly? Are you a stickler for good grammar, or do you think that language is always evolving and new words and meanings are happening all the time? Call in now with your take at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ben Bromley joins us now. He's a columnist for the Baraboo News Republic. He recently wrote an article titled Word Misuse is Literally a Crisis. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob and Veronica, I am literally over the moon to be on your program.
Now, this is, in your column, this is one of the words that triggered you to write this, has led you to write this column. What is it about the way people use the word literally that bugs you?
Well, I think it's because they use it in a way that is completely opposite of its intended meaning. Of course, people mean figuratively most of the time when they say literally.
But think about that. If you say, I am figuratively over the moon, it's not as catchy. It's not as fun to say.
I don't think anyone thinks of word nerds as being lots of fun.
Well, are you, Ben, are you a word nerd yourself?
I am a bit of a word nerd, a bit of an English snob at times. I've written many, many columns where I assemble my mythical word crimes tribunal, where we rail against various misuses of the English language. And as you might imagine, when you get a lot of word nerds together, we have some pretty wild parties. We have big bongs full of Pinot Grigio, and if things get crazy, we might end up with a copy of Merriam-Webster's dictionary on our heads.
Well, that's how it all gets started, isn't it?
Indeed.
Well, there's another book you reference in your latest piece, Garner's Modern American Usage, and I guess there's a scale there for different stages of word misuse. What is that?
Well, that was one happy accident, thanks to the miracle of the Google machine. As I was researching the column about the use of the word literally, I happened to just stumble upon that, and I think that's a great idea. There's all kinds of misuses out there that we need to keep our eye on. Another one, in my opinion, is the overuse of the term amazing. I don't know if you've noticed this, but it seems like right now, if anything is above average, it is amazing. It's never stupendous or extraordinary. It's always amazing.
And it's usually inflected like, amazing.
True.
To make it doubly amazing. So in terms of literally, where you started off, this is when it really bugs you, people using it the exact opposite of what it actually means. Where does this fall in this usage scale? Is it pretty bad? Is it almost gone?
No, they've got it only in the intermediate stage, where it's causing alarms, you know, at dictionary headquarters, but it's not quite all the way to being completely misused.
Well, thinking about the amazing one, one that I've often been guilty of is I've downgraded the word awesome to, you know, instead of something that actually fills my brain with a sense of transcendent awe, I'm happy that you've handed me my cup of coffee or something like that. Is that really awesome? Is that something that we do a lot, take that word that's really way, way out there in scale and really bring it into mundane use like that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, the awesome is supposed to mean that you're overcome with a sense of wonder.
Debilitated by wonder.
It's one thing to look at the Grand Canyon and be awed, but if you're awed by a cup of coffee, I think you need to revisit your life.
I'm pretty hooked, though, to be fair.
But, I mean, won't people who evaluate words for dictionaries say, well, if that word is being used like that by a majority of people, well, guess what? It is okay to use literally to mean what people are saying it means right now.
Indeed, and that has even happened. It's creeping into dictionaries, and they usually will have sort of a caveat where saying, okay, well, it's used this way, and a lot of people consider it a misuse, but I think that's one step toward, literally sort of taking on a whole new meaning.
And as a word nerd, do you view it as your job to push back, to keep things from progressing to that stage where it goes from a misuse of the word to just giving up and redefining the word?
Absolutely. I try, but I think, as you mentioned earlier, the thing about language is it's always evolving, it's always changing, so anyone who tries to sound the bell of conservatism is fighting a losing battle, and I figure long range, down the line, we'll all just be communicating via emoji anyway.
Well, I mean, given what you just said, that it is hard to pin down language. It is moving. It is changing. It's a moving target. So why not just accept it? Why not just get on board and say you are literally over the moon to talk about this today?
Well, Veronica, I have to write a column every week. I got to come up with something. No, but I do think there's a lot of people out there, and actually it's the whole Word Crimes Tribunal thing started with a conversation I'd had with my father, and he shares this same frustration when things are misused to the point where they start to become common usage, and it's, I don't know, there's just something about it that sort of makes your hair stand on end, and you want to slap people around a little bit.
We are having an awesome conversation about something that's literally a life or death issue with Ben Bromley. He's a columnist for the Baraboo News Republic. Recently wrote an op-ed titled, Word Misuse is Literally a Crisis. And we'll bring in our callers now. We've got Irene with us in Phillips. Irene, hi. Irene? Oh, Irene is not there. Let's try John in Madison. John, hi.
Hello, this is in relation to the use of the word either. I hear this on all different kinds of TV shows continually, in architectural settings and whatever. What they mean to say is both, but they never say both. They say either, meaning one or the other, but they mean both. The two words are not the same. Hmm. Either is always to be used with the word or.
Either or, but both. Okay, I think I get you, John. And Ben, is that one that's on your radar?
You know, it's not. Maybe I'll have to look into it.
Well, either of us could, too.
There's a lot of those out there, though. I think there's stuff like, non-words, like irregardless. You hear that quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's not even a word, and it just drives people crazy. Or the same thing along the lines of if someone says, I could care less. Well, that's another case where, like, literally it's the exact opposite of what you're trying to say. Trying to say that you couldn't care less.
Weary and wary get stuck in my craw. Not literally, figuratively. Those two bug me because people confuse them a lot. And where's the outrage?
That's what I want
to know. I think there should be outrage. Does that one bug you?
Of course, absolutely.
Are there ones that are new to you, Ben, that you hadn't seen in the past so much? Because literally, I think that one's been on the rise for a while. Are there ones that are just starting to show up that are on your warning list, your watch list?
Well, you know, I don't want to give away the store, since I know everyone out there is eagerly looking forward to my upcoming columns. But yes, there's no shortage of examples out there. I think for the moment they literally grabbed me just because just this past weekend I heard on ESPN they did this feature on the woes of Cleveland sports fans, and one of the interview subjects said that the Cleveland Indians had literally been in a coma since the 1970s.
That would be a problem, though.
It would indeed. And what was really disturbing was the guy who's being interviewed is a writer for Esquire, so we expect better.
Okay, let's go back to our phone calls, and see what they have to say. Susan next in the Wisconsin Dells. Susan, hi.
Hi. My gripe is people who say, for you and I, for you or I, between you and I, to you and I, it has to be for you and me. You would never say for I, you would say for me. But people don't use I as the subject there. That's the only time you could use I would be in a subject format. And then I have a ton of other ones. People who pronounce veteran as veteran, two-syllable word. It's three syllables. So is family. And veterinarian is multiple syllables.
Questions of diction getting into there, Susan. I think I'm guilty of that one sometimes.
I sure am.
Veteran. Because I think it sounds more conversational. That's my rationale. Even though there is that extra E in there, veteran, it doesn't sound right to the ear. But
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe Susan is right. What do you think about that one, Ben?
Yeah, that might be a regional thing, too, you know, as far as how pronunciation. I guess pronunciation doesn't bother me as much as if it's used correctly in the right context.
Yeah, you're more of a print guy, Ben, so you're not
right.
So worried about how we say it out loud.
Say, you guys in the radio world have to worry about pronunciation. I just have to know how to spell.
All right, let's go back to our callers. Thanks a lot for those, Susan. We've got Shannon with us now in Franklin. Shannon, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. There's a word that my sister-in-law uses, and it's the word really. And whenever she gets upset, she's like, really? Really? Or if she wants to be condescending, she's like, really?
Well, so that's not necessarily a misuse, I guess, but an exaggeration. There was a whole Saturday Night Live bit using the word really in that sort of critical, almost condescending way. I wonder if that's where your sister-in-law got it, Ben. But that kind of tag word, what do you think, Ben?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's that's one where it's almost you could just be saying, figuratively? Figuratively?
We can try to start that.
It's not quite
I don't know if it's going to take off.
Figuratively? Yeah, okay, I can do that.
Saturday Night Live does set a lot of trends for words, and I know that really one I'm pretty sure must have started there, and it's got legs. It just keeps on going and going.
It seems to. I also think there's a lot of words out there that are getting turned into verbs. For example, you know, people are vacuuming, even though, you know, vacuum isn't technically a verb, and now you see that with, well, you know, 30 years ago it would have been Xeroxing, and now people are texting and Facebooking.
The verbifying of our language. Well, we're talking right now with columnist Ben Bromley, talking about grammatical mistakes and the misuse of words. We want to hear from you on this one.
Yeah, we'll continue conversationing with Ben, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Do you have a pet peeve when it comes to how people use the language, how they misuse particular words or phrases? And do you correct people if they're getting it wrong, or do you just let it go, not start the fight? If you don't have any of these pet peeves, do you think this is just how language works? It changes. We should get over it. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now about word misuse. For example, when we use the word literally or maybe ironic incorrectly, or we mix up a phrase and say something like, I could care less.
We know this gets on the nerves of some people. We know our listeners feel strongly about language one way or another. Does it get on your nerves when people misuse words or use incorrect grammar? Or do you think that, hey, language changes, we use it, it changes as we use it. What do you think? Call now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll get back to our conversation with Ben Bromley now, who recently wrote a piece called Word Misuse is Literally a Crime. And we'll go back to our callers. Bob is with us next in Madison. Bob, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, my favorite word to hate lately is absolutely, but I think I've heard it 3 times now on your program.
Really? Guilty as charged.
If you want a good critique on what absolute is, you got to read Moby Dick.
So wait, we have to read Moby Dick to figure out how to use absolutely?
We absolutely do.
Okay.
So, Ben, what do you think? And this is one I'll do, instead of saying yes, I'll say absolutely. I'm sure I've done that sometimes. Is that one that, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Is that one that you've encountered or done yourself?
I think you just caught me. I think I said absolutely earlier. I think I'm busted.
J'accuse.
Exactly.
You got some reading ahead of you, my friend.
Yeah, Moby Dick. Let's start a book club.
The Absolutely Book Club. All right, Bob, thanks for that. And on to Pamela in Independence. Pamela, hi.
Hi there. I teach, and so I have quite a difficult time when I have faculty members that use words incorrectly, especially these two. When someone wants to borrow something from me, and I'm happy to lend it to them, but they will say, oh, would you borrow me a pencil? Just fingernails on the chalkboard. I mean, it's totally an incorrect usage. But they look at me, you know, like deer in headlights, like because I'm staring at them like, what are you saying to me? Because I have no idea what you mean. And so it's rather ubiquitous because it is everywhere.
Right, Pamela, that is one that, yeah, that one still persists, the borrow me something instead of lending.
And I'll say I've done this. I have a friend who used to do that ironically, and I started doing it kind of ironically. And then this is the curse of my language, that I just start saying it like a normal thing. Is that one you see much, Ben?
I was going to say absolutely, but then I caught myself. I think that's one too, where the caller faces that dilemma of you'd really like to correct the person because you know it makes that person sound, you know, not as smart as they probably are, and yet, you know, if you do that, then all of a sudden you are the holier than thou, you know, word nerd. It's easier for me to sort of do it from behind my keyboard and not be addressing someone directly.
Yeah, I feel like language shaming, that kind of, or it could be, if it's okay, if it's in jest. If you say it with a light touch, you can kind of point it out to someone. But if you really come in swinging on those, it can be a little intense.
Or what if we just looked at them and then said, really? Really?
And I'm sure that has happened.
What kind of response do you get when you write pieces like this, Ben? Are people on board and jumping in and sharing other ones?
They are indeed. In fact, when you mentioned other examples, I can lay a couple on you. But whenever I write a column like this, I inevitably get emails back that the people list their, you know, their pet peeves, and I just tuck them aside and use those for my next column. And I thank everyone for doing my work for me. But I know one out there is, for example, there's a lot of, well, essentially redundancies out there. Like you'll hear people talk about past history, you know, as opposed to what's in your future history. You know, oh, what's in his past history? Or they'll say, oh, this is a company will come up with a new innovation. Well, of course, you know, it's either an innovation or it's new. It doesn't have to be both.
Well, Pamela, thanks a lot. And we go next to Irene in Phillips. Hi, Irene.
Hi. Sorry, folks. I pressed the wrong button before and you lost me, or I lost you.
It happens.
You're back.
Thank you. The word that drives me nuts is regime, people using regime instead of regimen.
Uh-huh.
For like exercise?
Yeah, well, regimen would be a good exercise or a diet plan. When they use regime instead of that, I mean, I think of a military or authoritarian governments, you know. Anyway, they're not interchangeable. Am I right, Mr.
Ben, is she right?
I was going to say, you see not only regime and regimen, but more often I see regiment, as in the military troop substituted for regiment, and that's a whole different deal. It can change the meaning of your sentence quite a bit.
Is there any crossover there, though? Because often when one takes up a new plan, it does feel sort of militaristic.
If you're going to boot camp at the at the fitness club, maybe.
I need somebody to impose some regime change on my exercise program, so maybe there's something to that. Hey, we're talking language usage and, more accurately, language misusage with Ben Bromley. He's a columnist for the La Crosse Tribune, just in front of me here. He writes in Baraboo at the News Republic, and he's talking about the misuse of language. He wrote a piece in a recent article. We'll go back to our callers now with Carol on the line in Milwaukee.
Hi. Yeah, one of my biggest pet peeves is when people talk about quantities of plurals. Like, they say there are less people instead of fewer people. It drives me crazy.
Yeah, that can be a sticky one. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah,
is there an easy way to remember that?
That's a good one. That is really frequently misused, to the point where I'm guessing most people don't realize that they are misusing it. That, yeah, you have, you know, there are fewer than 8 ducks walking past you on the street, not less than 8 ducks, that kind of thing.
Carol, thanks a lot for that. And we go to Laura in Manitowoc. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have 2. The first one has been really driving me crazy, and I don't know if I'm right about it or not, so I'm hoping you'll just say, nope, you have that wrong, and then I can stop being bothered. But it's when you use a word that indicates a quantity, such as a lot or several or many, it seems like people choose the wrong verb of being. They use the wrong tense. So if I'm going to say there are a lot of books, I would say there are a lot. But I very often hear people say there's a lot. In fact, I heard it many times on your show so far. There's many choices. There's many days. There's a lot of opportunities. I think it should be there are a lot, and a lot of times people will use that with a contraction, so they'll say, you know, there's a lot. And then my other one is the first person reflexive pronoun. It seems like more and more I'm hearing this these days, people want to get it correct, and they say, give it to my colleague and myself, when they're telling, you know, a second person to give something to their colleague and to the person speaking. People are very often saying myself to try to sound, I guess, more learned, and it comes out sounding, to me at least, less learned. It should be give it to my colleague and me.
Those are both good ones. And in fact, yeah, the first one,
yeah.
There's a lot of blah, blah, blah.
If I'm writing, I got to stop and think about that, and I don't know,
right
you?
There, I think everybody has these sort of brain sort of fogs where you enter in and you try, you know that this is where you stumble, and sometimes you can't find the word. And maybe I'm just speaking for me here.
Me too.
For me, that is lie and lay.
Oof.
And I know, and I've gone through it, and I've tried, but my brain just shuts down. Every system powers down when I have to pick that word.
There's no lie. Ben, what's one that stymies you, one that you, as you're writing, have to think about, maybe even go to a reference source?
Oh, yeah. Veronica just hit one. Yeah, the lay-lie thing. I always have to double-check that one, and there are certain words, you know, every time I spell accommodate, that one takes me about 3 minutes, you know, one letter at a time. And it makes me grateful that I get the benefit of being at the keyboard and getting to make revisions as opposed to speaking extemporaneously like you folks do. As the caller mentioned, I'm sure we committed 2 or 3 word crimes just in the course of this interview.
Well, Ben, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Literally heaven.
Literally and figuratively, a lot of fun. That was a columnist, Ben Bromley, talking about his latest piece. It's called Word Misuse is Literally a Crime. You can find a link over at the Central Time Facebook page, and you can share your own pet peeves and maybe own up to ones that give you a hard time. You know, hearing all these, it actually makes me feel good because there's no way you're going to avoid it. We just got to talk and do the best we can.
I'm glad you feel good. I feel like I have to be a lot more careful.
No, I just gave up. I give up.
All right, let us know if we mess up. No, don't tell us. We don't want to know. This is Central Time.
Superheroes are ruling the movie scene again with the newest Captain America movie called Captain America Civil War on top of the U.S. box office charts for the second weekend in a row.
The movie is closing in on $1 billion in ticket sales worldwide, and at least some of that came from the pivotal Central Time host demographic. That is to say, Rob, us.
We both saw it this weekend. We both put our money into that nearly $1 billion total. Is a superhero movie. What did you think?
I like superhero movies. I like the Marvel franchise. And I heard that this one was really good. So yeah. That's my setup going in. And then I got a little bored. I was a little bored, and I'm never bored in action movies, and I ended up sort of like thinking of random things and grocery lists and things during the movie.
Yeah, that's exactly what the makers are hoping to elicit in the viewer. Yeah, I've been thinking of this for a long time, and I'm not the first person to say this. I think we may be at some kind of peak superhero zone where I just, there's superheroes, and they're fighting each other. Spoiler alert, they fight each other. Civil War might have tipped you off there. It's just not quite doing it for me, and yet I'll probably see the next one.
The Ant-Man character was funny.
Which I haven't seen that movie.
And I had not seen that movie. And also their version of Peter Parker, Spider-Man, was funny. Hopefully those are not spoilers, but those were some funny bits in it.
Pretty good. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.